Hi, and welcome to the Beyond the Peloton podcast. Welcome back. We are talking about Milan San Remo, how Wout van Aert had an amazing win there over last weekend. Tour de l'An, how Primoz Roglic and the Jumbo Visma team just absolutely destroyed Ineos, and what that means for the Tour de France. And also, we'll be doing a slight preview of the Critérium du Dauphiné, formerly the Dauphiné Libéré, which is a huge Tour de France tune-up race. I am a little conflicted. There is all these races are coming so thick and fast. Next weekend, there's Giro de Lombardia in Italy. I don't think we're going to have time to preview it in this episode, so I might release a preview episode right before the weekend. So keep an eye out for that. So first off, I'm away from the Beyond the Peloton podcast world headquarters, so I apologize if we're away from our state-of-the-art recording studio. So if the sound quality is lower this week, that is why, and I apologize. I'll be back as soon as I can. So let's talk about Milan San Remo. Wout van Aert had an amazing win, and to back that up against his Strada Bianchi win the week before is just incredible. I mean, it's like we're watching like an emergence of a new superstar in the sport. It's like Fabian Cancellara, Tom Boonen level dominance. Because to come into this race, and everyone knows you're probably the strongest rider. You've proven it the week before, and everyone's watching you. And then to still win is incredibly hard. And it's why I didn't bet on him. I thought that he would just be too marked. The favorite rarely ever wins here. So for him to do that, it's absolutely incredible. I almost can't overstate how incredible that is. And he is absolutely flying right now. But so he won Strada Bianchi, Milan San Remo. He has a monument win already at 25. And then, but now he's got to change gears a little bit because he goes to the Dauphiné Libéré tomorrow. So Wednesday is probably when you're listening to this. And then the Tour de France, but he won't be riding for himself at these races. He's going to be working for the team. So there probably was some internal pressure on himself to get some results before he goes in the teammate mode. But it was as I expected. It's 300 kilometers long. The new route was beautiful to look at. It had absolutely no impact on the racing. They really just started racing at the base of the Chapresa, which is about 20K out. But they flew up that thing. Like they're going into that climb like it's a sprint finish. I couldn't believe how fast they were going into it. And then right away, two of the sprinters are dropped. I thought this race is called the Sprinters Classic. The last 3 years, sprinters have not won. I got a WhatsApp message from a friend this morning about like, so you explain that it's no longer a sprinter's race and then you bet on sprinters. What are you doing? Take your own advice. In retrospect, I should have done it. I just thought that there would be a reversion to the mean. Maybe they wouldn't go up these climbs quite as fast as they have in the past, but Gaviria and Caleb Ewan, two of the best sprinters in the world, are gone 20 kilometers from the finish at the Sprinters Classic. So right there, I'm like, yeah, I'm not feeling that great about my predictions here. They get to the Poggio. They absolutely fly up that thing. I timed it in about 5 minutes, 56 seconds. I mean, anything sub six is like supersonic. Just to put this into perspective, in 2015, John Degenkolb won the race. He's a traditional sprinter. And, well, so yeah, 2014, Alexander Kristoff, also a traditional sprinter. Next year, John Degenkolb, traditional sprinter. Those 2 years, they went up the Poggio in 2014, 6 minutes, 50 seconds. In 2015, 6 minutes, 26 seconds. So significantly slower. In 2014, that's a minute slower than they did last weekend. So you can see that maybe the blueprint's out there for the, if you're a motivated team with kind of a fast but non, traditional sprinter rider like Wout van Aert, Alaphilippe, Vincenzo Nibali, you just got to like hammer these climbs. And that's what they've been doing since. So in 2015, they do it in 6 minutes, 26 seconds. 2016, it's 6 minutes, 10 seconds. 2017, it's 5 minutes, 55 seconds. And that race is won by, I believe, Mikhail Kwiatkowski. 2018, it's 6 minutes, 13 seconds. That race is won by Vincenzo Nibali. 2019 one by Julian Alaphilippe. They go up that thing in 5 minutes and 50 seconds. It's one of the fastest times of all time. It might be the fastest. Nope. I'm seeing in 1995, 5 minutes, 46 seconds. My Lord, that is fast. But that was a different era of the sport, shall we say. That's a turbocharged era when EPO was just coming in. So they're flying up this thing. My picks are in the toilet. But Alaphilippe, Julian Alaphilippe, last year's winner, actually gets clear. There's a fairly motivated group behind him. It's a thinning peloton, but it's there. Sam Bennett, my favorite for the day, is dropped. He is just absolutely fighting to hang on. I mean, I thought he was fit enough to get over, but to go sub six is just, I don't think a big sprinter could do it. I think like Peter Sagan's probably like the max size you can be to get over a climb like that. So Alaphilippe, you know, tiny, tiny guy, light climber, just flying up this thing. Wout van Aert, he also jumps out of the group with him, but he doesn't, like, the key moment is he doesn't panic. He gets dropped towards the top, but he doesn't panic. He doesn't go into the red. He just rides his own pace. I'm saying he doesn't go into the red. He's probably riding like 600-700 watts, but he's managing his load at that effort, which is incredible to think about. So, but Alaphilippe crests alone. Van Aert's a few seconds behind him. The peloton's a few seconds behind them. And Alaphilippe makes a few mistakes. The descent's really tricky. So you're about 5.7 kilometers from the finish at this point. The descent is really tricky. Alaphilippe makes a few mistakes. Van Aert is such a good bike handler. He just cleanly descends this thing, catches him about halfway down. And then he's just got ice in his veins. Because at this point, in the past, a lot of these groups have been pulled back by the peloton chasing. But I think they had just gone up it just fast enough that the peloton was depleted. Even though there's a big group behind, there was really no one in that group stronger than those two riders. And there's really not that many motivated riders to work because everyone's sitting in, hoping it gets brought back, waiting for someone else to do the work. You saw like Tej Benoot working for Philippe Gilbert, who was trying to do the monument sweep. You know, and Benoot's strong, but he's not stronger than Wout van Aert and Julian Alaphilippe combined. And they just can't quite pull him back. And Van Aert, Alaphilippe is smartly sitting on his wheel. He's not as good a sprinter as Van Aert. And Van Aert just doesn't panic. He just stays on the front. He's going just hard enough. And the peloton got close, like really close. It looked like they were going to pull him back. My boy, Matej Mohoric, just absolutely flew down the descent. I thought he was going to catch him, blow by him. My long shot pick was going to pay off. Didn't quite happen. But then Van Aert took the sprint out early because he knew that they were going to get caught if he didn't. Alaphilippe sat on his wheel, was coming around him, and Van Aert's just so strong he couldn't do it. He just held him off sprinting from the front, which is, it's incredible. Like, we're watching greatness in the making here. So let's just all applaud Wout van Aert. He ruined my picks, but I don't even care. It's so cool to watch him come into his own as a superstar of the sport, and it's great to get some new blood in there and mix it up and, you know, put the established guys in their place a little bit. I think it's so cool. So, and a lot of people were rooting for Gilbert. I was not surprised to see him not win because, you know, like 10 years ago, Philippe Gilbert, this is tailor-made for him. He's going to go with that group. He's going to go with Alaphilippe and Wout van Aert on the Poggio, and he's going to out-sprint him. Like, he would have cleaned their clocks, but you know, he's 38. He can't quite get over the Poggio as fast as them, and then he's not a fast enough sprinter to win out of that group. I mean, let's look at the results sheet. He was ninth, so he was seventh in the bunch sprint. Michael Matthews won it, and third is actually that's a great result for him. Peter Sagan was fourth. Matthews he's a similar rider to Peter Sagan, but is just never as good, so he's kind of had a cursed career, but to win that bunch sprint for Matthews is really impressive. He would have won that race if it came down to a bunch sprint. So I think that's all we need to say about that. It's an exciting race for the final few kilometers, but it's the weakest. People are going to get mad at me for saying this. It's the weakest of the monuments just because the route's so predictable. I think it's too long. The length makes it incentivize riders just to sit in and wait for those last few climbs. But it's beautiful when it goes off. And just one more note about Milan Sanremo is, so Wout van Aert is kind of the counterparty to Matthew Vanderpool. They're both cyclocross world champions, same age, have come up together. One's Dutch, one's Belgian, big rivals. Up until this point, everyone's just assumed Matthew Vanderpool is the future of the sport. Van Aert's a good rider, but, you know, just not quite as good. I think this, I for a long time have thought Van Aert's the better of the two, and this season is proving that out. And I spent yesterday morning watching Vanderpool. So in 2019, he was incredible. I was just watching, you know, highlight videos of some of his wins, and he was just the strongest rider. I think he was the strongest rider on earth for a few months. And then if you watch this season, he hasn't won a race. He was leading the peloton coming into Sanremo, and last year he just would have mowed down Alaphilippe and Van Aert, which he did at Amstel Gold last year, and then sprinted. I think he led out the sprint for 50 seconds. He averaged close to 1,000 watts, which is 1,000 watts, which is absurd. And he would have won that race. So there's something not quite. He hasn't been the same in my mind since he cracked at the Road World Championships in September. So either he's burnt out, maybe he went too deep and his body's still not able to recover, but that's something to keep an eye on. He's not quite where he was. And even his team, his Alpecin Phoenix team manager, his comments after the race were, the result is not what we expected. We have to be very honest about that. I don't want to say that he's not as good as we expected, but the flash that we're used to from him is not there, or he certainly hasn't used it. It's too early to draw conclusions, but it's not pleasant. We expected more from these Italian races. So that's pretty damning words coming from his team manager. So I think that's interesting. I think he's overextended himself with his racing schedule, and we'll see if he can course correct coming into the classics post Tour de France. But I don't have high hopes. I think this is going to be a rough season for him. But I'm enjoying seeing Wout van Aert get some time in the sun at his expense a little bit. So also over the weekend, so Milan Sanremo is a monument of the sport. It's a World Tour race. It's nominally the most important race this weekend. I think Tour de l'An, which was a three-stage race in the south of France. It's like a nothing race. No one would ever care about this race. But this year, it was kind of a dress rehearsal for the Tour de France. Stage 3 was an exact replica of Stage 15 at this year's Tour. And Team Ineos and Team Jumbo-Visma, the two favorites for the Tour, brought their Tour de France teams. Well, there's a few minor differences, but they brought their Tour de France contenders. Ineos had Egan Bernal, Geraint Thomas, Chris Froome. Jumbo-Visma had Tom Dumoulin, Primoz Roglic, and Steven Kruijswijk. So they each had their three strongest riders. And my lord, did Ineos get their butt kicked. I mean, it was not even close. They looked like the teams who have tried to beat Ineos in the past years. There's something not quite right with that team. They would, Roglic on stage one, which wasn't a mountain stage. It was kind of a limited bunch sprint. Roglic almost wins it, being led out by Tom Dumoulin. Froome gets dropped. Froome's like minutes behind on not a hard stage. So right there, something's not right. Stage two, Froome is dropped way out. And Roglic just kicks Egan Bernal's butt on a climb. And Bernal is supposed to be the strongest climber in the world. And Roglic is supposed to be a time trialist. So if he's winning climbs, it's like this tour is over before it starts. They can't beat him. And then stage three, it's just a nut. Like Ineos tries to put Jumbo-Visma under pressure there on the Grand Colombier, which was the final climb. You know, they're doing the Ineos train. The table set, it looks normal, and they're just not strong enough. Like there, Chris Froome, who actually had quite a bit better day on stage three, I was looking at his power numbers. He said he was at, I believe, like 69 kilos and putting out like close to, it was like 370 watts average. It worked out to like 6.2 watts per kilos, which is, there's like a Ferrari calculation. You can take the VAM, so the vertical meters ascended, divided by the time per meter, and you can get a rough calculation of the watts per kilo that way. And it worked out to about 5.3, 5.4. So I don't think he's quite at his race weight like he claims. But that's pretty good from Froome. I mean, he's not going to win the Tour de France. He's not even going to come close at that fitness level, but he could be a serviceable domestique. And he was doing a pretty good job on stage three, but he was not putting anyone under pressure, at least anyone on Jumbo-Visma. They were just easily hanging in there. So that's not a good sign. I mean, where you got to remember, the Dauphiné Libéré is seen as the dress rehearsal for the Tour de France, and oftentimes the winner goes on to win the Tour de France. I'm looking at 2012, Bradley Wiggins won the Dauphiné. 2013, Chris Froome, both of them won the Tour those respective years. 2015, Chris Froome won the Tour de France. 2016, Chris Froome won the Dauphiné, won the Tour de France. Geraint Thomas, 2018, won the Dauphiné, won the Tour de France. And the Dauphiné's 25 finishes 25 days before the first mountain stage of the Tour, usually. But so Sunday was 19 or 20 days from the first mountain stage of the Tour de France. So actually, this race is more indicative of the Tour than the Dauphiné Libéré normally is. So where, like, this is like, they should be hitting the panic button. Like, Froome was okay. And now it looks like they're going to have to take him to the, like, he couldn't possibly be left off the Tour squad because there's no one better than him. Like, Bernal is, you know, was clearly the, he was, Bernal didn't get dropped. He was just, well, he would get dropped by Primoz Roglic close to the finish on both mountain stages. So he was the second best rider in the race, but, and obviously the strongest rider on Ineos, but there was no one, he didn't have any strong teammates. I mean, Jonathan Castroviejo looked okay, but you'd think with two Tour de France winners working for him, you know, he'd have the strongest team by far. But Geraint Thomas looked terrible. Chris Froome looked okay. And they're both going to have to go to the Tour because they don't seem to have anyone stronger. They have Pavel Sivakov, who we know is great. We know he's in shape right now. He's going to be on the team. But I think they're going to have to take Froome because they don't have anyone else, which is almost inconceivable at their budget level, which is, I think it's slightly over $50 million a year, and the average budget is about $20 million a year. So it's like something is wrong with that team. There's something is broken down in the management and the training and the logistics where they're not where they need to be prior to the Tour. But what's great, this schedule is so condensed. It's so hard to keep up with. There's races just coming thick and fast. We're going to get to see again on Wednesday because the Dauphiné Libéré, it's five stages and I think it's five mountaintop finishes. It's just every day is basically a preview of a mountain stage of the upcoming Tour de France. So it's going to be very exciting to watch. But if Roglic holds this form, he could win every one of those stages. There's no one stronger than him in the world right now. So the final stage of the Tour de Lan, and interesting to note is with 6 kilometers. So Froome pulled off at about 9K to go, but he was hammering. Like, it was Froome and then Jonathan Castroviejo just absolutely drilling it. And Egan Bernal was sitting last wheel in that group. So just showing that, like, you would assume he's hurting. Like, why else would he be back there and not with his team? But the team wasn't responding to that at all. They were just going on business as usual. And I don't know if that was just, you know, maybe Bernal communicated he was fine. He just preferred to sit at the back. But it almost looked like they were trying to drop him. That's what I took from it. It was a not great show of teamwork from Ineos, in my opinion. And when Froome pulled off, he really, I was looking at his power files, and he hit like close to 500 watts. He just kind of was just drilling it before he pulled off, which doesn't make a ton of sense. If you have energy left, you always go longer, not harder. He's more valuable to the team there if he can just take it a kilometer more versus drilling it and then pulling off to the side. My take was that it was a little bit of trying to put Bernal into trouble and drop him and muddy the leadership picture a bit. That's what I took from it. And then, so with 6K to go, Bernal's just kind of isolated with four Jumbo-Visma riders left. And Roglic pulls off, drops back, goes to the back of the group and just kind of looks at Bernal to see how he's doing. It was almost like a taunting move. And then he rode with him for a little bit. And then he pulled off to the side of the road, said something to him, and then rode back to the front. It was almost like faux encouragement or something like that. I thought it was like a real power play. Roglic really, really feeling himself if he's dropping back to taunt and talk trash to the defending Tour de France champion. And, you know, then Bernal, I don't know if he was on the limit, if he thought he was on the limit, but, you know, Richie Porte starts to attack. Richie Porte has two pretty substantial attacks that disrupt the group, drop a lot of the riders, and then Bernal attack. I think, you know, part of Roglic's thinking was he was worried about Bernal sitting last wheel and being able to wind up an attack. And then by the time he's going by you at the front, he's going double your speed. So it's really hard to respond to that. So perhaps he was just dropping back so that if there was an attack, he would be able to respond. And then that ended up happening with about, I think it was like a little under a kilometer to go. Bernal attacks from the back. It's what Roglic was worried about. But he's been thinking about this for a while. He's able to respond easily, catches him, and then counters him with 200 meters to go and just absolutely drops him. Like he put 10 seconds into him. And it looked like if he wanted to, he could have attacked 5 kilometers out and just dropped everyone by minutes. Like he was not in trouble at all. So I thought that was some interesting dynamics going on there in the last stage. I don't understand what Ineos's tactics were. And I don't think it bodes well for the coziness in that team and the feeling of camaraderie. If I was Bernal, I'd be pretty pissed that my teammates were seemingly trying to drop me when I'm second overall at a stage race. Oh, so two more notes about three more notes about performances at this past weekend's Tour de l'An. Tom Dumoulin, who I don't think he's raced since the Giro d'Italia in 2019, he crashed out early, so that's like 18 months ago or something like that. So he hasn't raced for a long time. He looked very good. He wasn't winning, obviously. His teammate was winning, but he was doing incredible amounts of work on the front. He was shredding this race to pieces. He looks close to back to his best. So that's an important note close to the Tour de France. He's going to be like a great second option for Jumbo-Visma in the Tour this year. And Nairo Quintana, who we were talking about in the first episode, Nairo was looking great early in the year. He was hit by a car when he was training back home in Colombia. He looked pretty strong. He got third in this race overall. And Richie Porte, who I haven't thought about for years as someone who could like be a protagonist in the Tour, he looked pretty strong in the last mountain stage. He was making the attacks that actually blew Jumbo's train up. So the Dauphiné Libéré, which starts on Wednesday, Wednesday, August 12th, and it's 5 stages, so it goes Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, finishes Sunday. Just a quick note about this. Normally, it's run during the French Open tennis event, so it's like so early. Like the stages will finish like 7 a.m., 6 a.m. Mountain Time U.S., because they want to finish it before the broadcast for the French Open starts. But this year, there's no French Open, so I think they finish at like a normal time. So it's like 5 p.m. Central European time. So we should hopefully get to see a little bit more of this race than we normally get to, which is important because it's essentially a mini Tour de France. And almost all the contenders are going to be there. If the Tour de l'An was indicative of the Tour, this is going to be even more important because it's going to finish, you know, basically 2 weeks before the first mountain stage of the Tour de France. So this is even more, it's even more important than it normally is just because of this condensed schedule that we're in. And I mean, Jumbo-Visma's squad for this thing it's ridiculous. Like these teams are really bringing their A game. So as Ineos, as I noted, is bringing Bernal, Thomas, Froome, but they're also bringing Sivakov, who was not at Tour de l'An. And so that's going to be really interesting to watch. I think he's probably the second strongest rider on that team at the moment. So it'll be important to keep an eye on him. So Jumbo-Visma's squad for this thing I'm just looking it up. It's Primoz Roglic, Tom Dumoulin, Robert Hessink, Steven Kruijswijk, Sepp Kuss, an American, Tony Martin, and Wout van Aert. I mean, to have Wout van Aert, who's probably one of the strongest riders in the world right now, maybe is the strongest rider in the world and best race winner, just working as a domestique gives you an idea for how deep their team is. And in my mind, they've got to be considered the favorites of the tour for the tour and the strongest team in the world at the moment. And Ineos is Bernal, Jonathan Castroviejo, Chris Froome, Mikhail Kwiatkowski, Pavel Sivakov, Geraint Thomas, Dylan Van Baar. And there are, there's other riders in this race who could play a part. There's Thibaut Pinot on Grupo Upama FDJ. There is Nairo Quintana on Arkea Samsic. There's Adam Yates on Mitchelton Scott. I am tempted just to, I don't think they're going to play a part. If Jumbo is as strong as they've looked last weekend, I don't even think this is going to be a competition. I mean, I'm just looking at the betting odds right now on BetMGM. Primoz Roglic is a plus 130 for the overall win. It's absurd. So you'd have to risk $100 to win $130 back in a five-day stage race where anything could happen. Those are terrible odds. Egan Bernal is the second best favorite at plus 500, that's a little bit more reasonable. Tadej Pogacar, actually, I take back what I said. Tadej Pogacar is worth mentioning here. He beat Primoz Roglic recently in an uphill time trial, the Slovenian National Time Trial Championships. So, we know he's close to as strong, if not as strong or stronger, than Primoz Roglic. So that could be interesting. And there's less variables since this is pretty much just uphill the whole time and some downhills. Thibaut Pinot at plus 1400. Emmanuel Buchmann, who I believe was second at this race last year, at plus 1600. But important note, there's normally a time trial. There's no time trial this year. Bob Buchmann's a good time trialist, so he's not going to win. Adam Yates is plus 1600. Normally I think he could win, but these other contenders have seem so far off where Bernal and the Jumbo-Visma team are right now. Mikael Landa at plus 1600. I just don't see it. Alaphilippe at plus 1600. I think that, I don't know. He's strong, but some of these climbs are really tough. I think it's going to be too hard for him. Nairo Quintana at plus 2000. That's actually something interesting to think about because, he was third at Tour de Lan, he was nowhere near as strong as Bernal and Roglic, but he was close. I mean, if he's coming around after that car crash, it could be interesting. Richie Porte at plus 2,500. Do not bet on Richie Porte at this race. I think he came close to winning it once. And God, that must have been 2017. And then he thinks he got bullied on the last stage because riders were attacking him and beat him. He's not a killer, not a race winner. Pavel Sivakov at plus 2,500. That's actually interesting. If Bernal has any problems, Sivakov's going to be the leader on Ineos. So, it's not a non-zero chance of him winning. And then you have like Steven Kruijswijk at plus 3,300, Chris Froome at plus 3,300, Geraint Thomas at plus 5,000. None of them are going to win it. Tom Dumoulin at plus 5,000. I don't think so. It's just a little bit too hilly for him. And quick note about, I have some the betting odds in front of me for how they've changed for the Tour de France since last weekend. So Thomas drifted out. Geraint Thomas was on the first episode we did. We talked about his odds for the Tour, and he was at plus 900. So he was the fifth best favorite, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now he's at plus 1,400. Chris Froome was the second best favorite at plus 5,550. Now he's at plus 2,000. So you can see the markets are really starting to worry about Froome and Thomas after that performance last weekend. And I hope you got your Primoz Roglic bets in because he went from a plus 550 to now for the Tour de France, Primoz Roglic is plus 180. That's like almost like a sure. That's ridiculous. The markets are saying like he's a sure thing to win. I mean, you have to be so sure of him to bet on him at those prices. Egan Bernal drifted out slightly. He went from a plus 200 to a plus 225. That's not much of a change. And those are the big changes of note. But that I think that's interesting how, the money is now starting to worry about Thomas and Froome after what they've seen. So we'll keep an eye on those tour odds and how they're affected by the Dauphiné Libéré this week. And when we do next week's podcast, we'll kind of recap those again. So the Dauphiné Libéré, I don't know enough about. I don't have the stages like memorized, you know, climb by climb. But it's in the south of France. It's essentially a dress rehearsal for what it's like the late second week, early third week of the Tour de France. So it will be great to keep an eye on it. I think it's going to be the Jumbo show again, and Roglic is going to trounce everybody. It's not even going to be close. But keep an eye on Pogacar. You know, Bernal, it will be interesting to watch. He doesn't look quite there. If let's say he's coming along with his form, you know, maybe he shows something this week. Watch out for Pavel Sivakov as well. He would be my dark horse pick here. I don't even think we talked about his odds. I don't even see him on the... He's a plus 2,500 to win the overall here. So the only reason I would suggest not betting on him is so much would have to go wrong for Ineos for him to win. It would have to be... Bernal would have to completely fall apart or have a mechanical issue. So it's interesting, but I don't love it. This next weekend, it's got to be Saturday because the Italian races are always on Saturdays. Giro de Lombardia, which is normally in, I believe, like October. I think they call it the Race of the Falling Leaves. It either goes from Bergamo to Como or Como to Bergamo. They switch the routes up. I kind of like this the Strada Bianchi, Milano Sanremo, Giro de Lombardia. Three successive weekends, just like bang, bang, bang. They're kind of working their way up Italy. They're going from Tuscany, Milan, up to Como. It has a nice rhythm to it. It's like a nice narrative. Normally, they're really spread out over months. So I have not previewed this race like I should to give a proper breakdown of how things are going to go. They've run this same course since 2017. They haven't reversed it for a while. So, you know, when it starts in Bergamo, they kind of snake their way over to Lake Como. They go through the Bellagio Peninsula. There's a big climb. I'm going to butcher the name. I'm not going to say it, but there's like a huge climb. It's very steep at the top. There's like a cathedral that's dedicated to cycling at the top. It's very cool. And then they start to descend down and work their way, you know, down the lake into the town of Como. And it's very technical. It's a lot of technical descents. The climbs are incredibly steep. And the last few winners have been like, if you haven't won a Grand Tour that year, you're really trying for this race. It's definitely a climber's race. I mean, the last few winners have been Balco Mellema in 2019, Thibaut Pinot in 2018, Vincenzo Nibali in 2017. And then I believe it was Vincenzo who won in 2016. Esteban Chavez in 2016. So it's you know, kind of like a punchy climber, Grand Tour type rider. I believe Nibali is riding this year. He's getting up there in age. He's so good at this race, though. He's such a good descender. I mean, this race is like tailor-made for him with the steep climbs, tough descents. You've got to have a lot of... It gets pretty tactical coming into the finish, and you've just got to have like a cool, like he's just a killer with a cool head. He can do it all. It's a great race for him. It gets a little complicated because it's running concurrently with Dauphiné Libéré, so a lot of the riders who would normally be at Giro de Lombardia are busy at Dauphiné Libéré, so like Tom Dumoulin might be there, Primoz Roglic. Egan Bernal is a perfect rider for this race. He's not going to be there. So it's kind of spreading the contenders a little thin. I think it's going to make it a slightly watered down version of the race, which is sad, but it's a beautiful race. We should all watch it. It's great. I don't love that so we're going to have to split our time between watching this and the Dauphiné Libéré. We're going to get a lot of these overlaps coming up here in the next few months. I think there's a day where it's going to be a stage of the Vuelta a España, a stage of the Giro d'Italia, two Grand Tours, like two of the biggest races in the sport, and then a classic, also like which is also a big race on the same day. So there's some not great overlap here. I think they were just trying to do a little bit too much. I may be releasing a pod on like Thursday or Friday that delves into this a little bit more, but if I will absolutely be writing about it in the newsletter at, you can sign up at beyondthepeloton.substack.com and I'll have a little bit of info about it there. But so the main things we're going to look forward to this week are Dauphiné Libéré. Got to keep a close eye on that. I think there's going to be a lot of clues to the tour coming out of there. And then Lombardia. And let's see if Ineos can turn it around. I think they're such a professional operation, and they have so many strong riders. I think they're going to have a second wind here, and it's not just going to be Jumbo-Visma wiping the floor with them for 3 weeks in the tour. But I think it is going to be complicated for them. And what's good about this is the byproduct is going to be some of the most exciting racing we've seen in years at the tour. So that's great. So thanks for joining this week in this less than ideal episode. I haven't had a ton of time to prep. The recording setup is not what I'm used to. But thank you for joining me. Look out for that newsletter later this week. And please rate and review me on iTunes. It helps. Not iTunes, I guess it's Apple Podcast now. It helps other people find the show, and recommend it to a friend if you like it. So thank you so much, and have a great week.